Ready to take a deeper look at where history, politics, and economics all intersect? Well, then you've come to the right place. Each week, here's where we pull back the headlines and focus on the big trends, the stuff that actually shapes our future. Through the noise, we focus on the signal. I'm your host, Neil Howe, and this is Demography Unplugged, brought to you by Hedgeye Risk Management. Today is May 5th, 2020, and this is Demography Unplugged. Welcome back, everyone. As we did last week, I have on my podcast my fellow analyst, Christian Ford. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Neil. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. Everything all right in the state of Maine? I hope you return,
yes.
By the way.
I know.
I don't want you to get it lost down Maine there. So, but anyway.
Yeah, I will return.
You are nice and safe. That's what we ensure. As always, let me just remind people, if you want to dive deeper into all the stuff we talk about on Demography Unplugged, I recommend that you subscribe to my research product, Demography Unplugged, which I put together with my team, including Christian at Hedgeye Risk Management. So if you just Google it, that's the easiest way. Just Google Demography Unplugged. That'll take you there. And among other things, you will be able to watch my weekly show on COVID-19. That has actually been available the last, I don't know, 6-7 weeks. How long have we been doing that? I think it's
almost 2 months.
2 months now. It has been free, but I think this coming Thursday, again, always at or nearly always at 12:30 p.m. on Thursday. I believe this will be the last free public version. Then it will be behind our paywall. But again, if you want to get that, Demography Unplugged is the place to go to subscribe to that, as well as everything else we put out. So what are we going to talk about today? We're going to talk initially a little bit more about what else, COVID-19. But I'm going to do something different this time. We're going to talk a little bit about public attitudes toward social distancing and what that means for the opening up of the economy in the United States and other countries. So again, we're going to be talking about how Americans feel about it. And I think some of these results may be surprising. We actually featured them in our newswire yesterday. We're going to move on, as always, to markets. We're going to talk about U.S. economic indicators and in global indicators, how they're coming in. I guess they're pretty grim, but that's been the recent news. That's been the recent norm, right? The new normal. I'm going to spend some time looking at reasons why the markets are rebounding the way they are, particularly the S&P 500. I've had a lot of questions about that. I think it's the single most frequent question, why aren't markets down more than they are, given the enormity of economic bad news coming at investors. So I'll be going through and kind of discussing that. We're going to talk about politics around the world, and we're going to talk about politics in the United States. Among one thing we're going to be talking about is, when will Joe Biden get out of the basement? I mean, when is that going to happen, Christian? It's a bizarre campaign. You have to say it gives an advantage to the incumbent if the challenger, I mean, forget going door to door, but you can't have rallies. You can't do anything. This has got to be one of the most unusual election seasons, certainly of my lifetime in that respect. So let's move ahead to this item that we had yesterday. This is actually from the Washington Post, but it actually, we cite a whole bunch of polls. They all say the same thing. And that's the following, that even as many states, I think something like 31, 32 states either currently or plan to lift their stay-at-home orders, new polls indicate that tough social distancing restrictions continue to draw high bipartisan support. Fully 82% of Americans believe that state restrictions on businesses are either appropriate or indeed not restrictive enough. We go down here looking at, I mean, some of these numbers are fascinating to me. The one poll that we cite done by the University of Maryland along with the Washington Post, conducted in, about a week ago, found that just 17% of American adults said that the restrictions on businesses go too far. Only 14% said the same about restrictions on public gatherings. And this is about, anyway, between 10 and 15% said they go too far. Twice as many people, 26%, said the restrictions don't go far enough. Most, 61%, say these measures are about right. And when asked about specific policies, Americans overwhelmingly said that they favor shelter-in-place orders. 80% said that. The closure of bars and restaurants, 76%. Limits on gatherings of 10 or more people, 82%. And this has weakened slightly since the end of March. People are anxious to get outside. I think we all understand that. And I think also worth pointing out is that behind this sharp split, I mean, that obviously the Republicans are more in favor of going outside. I mean, this is part of this whole ideology of, right, the plandemic, and this is a hoax and so on. And you see that animating a little bit more of the Trump base than GOP as a whole. And one thing you have seen over time is that Democrats have grown somewhat more supportive of restrictions, while Republicans have become much less supportive. But here's what's interesting to me. Even most rank-and-file Republicans remain decisively in favor of these measures. And here's a Kaiser Family Foundation poll. This was conducted April 15th through 20th. 80% of Americans said that strict shelter-in-place measures are worth it. 94% of Democrats said that, 84% of independents, and 61% of Republicans. And maybe understandably, Republicans' support is somewhat higher in states having Republican governors, right? So you got a Democratic governor who's telling you to stay inside. Well, maybe you're a little bit more disgruntled. And again, whatever the guideline, and if you have access to this piece, you should read it. It's quite something. Here's another,
Neil. When in American politics has there been a policy that 80% of Americans agree on? The media is trying to make it seem like it's this huge amount of people who are against it, where the real story is how incredible how many people are for it.
How many people are for it, particularly, and this is another part of the story, particularly when they're reminded or particularly when they're told that if everyone were to follow this policy, you could actually successfully contain it, you know, through testing and tracking. And when they're reminded of countries that actually have contained it, you get even greater levels of support. One other aspect that's interesting, too, and here the conservative media are actually correct. Americans do support Trump's tough recent measures to block immigration. But even here, there's an interesting side story. Even many Democrats are on board with the block on immigration. And again, according to the Washington Post University of Maryland poll, 83% of Republicans supported the stopping of immigration, 67% of independents, and 49% of Democrats supporting a complete stop on immigration. So here, too, the real story is broad support for a measure that normally reflects deep partisanship. And, you know, you go along the line. We even have questions regarding, would you support a phone app that would share test results with public authorities or just simply allow, you know, inform people that if they need to be tested or if they've come into contact. Again, you get majorities of Americans approving of these ideas. And everyone, again, I want to come back to this, everyone's support really goes up when they are told that this will enable more people to return to work or school when the overall containment policy is successful. And I think that really points to the heart of the problem. People would be willing to support it if they had leadership that was consistently messaging this and was, you know, keeping the strays in line and actually, you know, making sure that this thing worked. I think where American support breaks down is when they sense that we have 50 different governors doing different things, and there's no real possibility that this is going to work, you know, for the nation as a whole, right? We're never going to be successfully follow through with something like they're doing in New Zealand or Singapore or Taiwan or something like that. So what the hell, you know, just let me go out and, you know, take my chances, right? It's a little bit of the tragedy of the commons in that regard. In my opinion, the moment of truth on all this, I've said this before, but the moment of truth will arrive in early June when we discover that easing up on the rules has not done much to restart the economy, but has triggered accelerating infection rates in many states. And at that point, it will be obvious that we have to go back, hunker down, and painfully regain all the territory we have lost. And I think when that happens, there will be hell to pay from the majority that was willing to stay the course.
Right.
You know, we didn't. So anyway, that's obviously we're going to talk more about that. Talk more about that and COVID in general on Thursday. So with that, let's go ahead and take a look at markets. And I think this is where, Christian, where you're on.
Yes, I will run through the numbers.
Okay.
All right. Well, over the last five market days, the S&P 500 is down 1.24%. It is still down 16% from its peak on February 19th, but it has made up about half of its losses since March 23rd. Now, when we go to the global Dow over the last five market days is also down 1.37%. And as for volatility, the VIX closed yesterday at 35.89. It's hovering in those mid-30s, similar to what it was doing last week.
It's not really changing much, right? I mean,
we
basically have this, what happened was it went down 33%, it regained about half that, and it's just treading water ever since. Kind of going up a little bit some weeks, went down a little bit last week. VIX is a little bit less than half of where it was at its peak. Wow. You know, where do you go from there? We're going to talk a little bit later, as I mentioned, why the market is not down further than it is, given the decline. Before we go there, why don't we go through some of the economic indicators? I know there are not a lot in the U.S., but I think there are a few.
Yeah, so in the U.S., we got the ISM manufacturing PMI for April, and that came in at 41.5. March, it had been 49.1, so it was actually above expectations, but it was still its steepest contraction since April of 2009. We also got the Richmond Fed Manufacturing Index. That came in at negative 53 for April. That is its lowest reading on record. And last month it was at 2.
How many? I think we track about 6 regional Fed indicators.
Yes.
I think about 3 or 4 of them have been a historic lows, right? I mean,
right. Everyone that's come out has been historic.
I mean, Dallas, Kansas, I think the Empire State, New York, Richmond. I don't know about Philadelphia. You know, just have to go through them.
Yeah.
But that's amazing. Okay. But not a lot. Obviously, I think next week will be, we're going to find out, well, actually on Friday of this week, we're going to find out the whole employment situation, right? That's going to be huge.
Yes. And will get more on that. You want to go over to Europe now, where we got some flash GDP growth numbers. So for the Eurozone in general, the flash Q1 numbers came in at negative 3.8%. That was just around expectations, but remember, these Q1 only include about 1 month of COVID. And it already is bringing it
down.
But
interestingly, let me ask you a question. It includes 1 month of COVID, but in Europe, it I'm not sure if this is true everywhere in Europe, or the Euro area. This is Euro area, right?
Yes.
I'm not sure that didn't that start somewhat before the United States? And the U.S. Q1 was actually a bigger hit, right? We were down 4.6, 4.8, something like that. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And but Italy and France obviously were down more than the rest of the euro area.
Yeah, Italy was down 4.7%, and France was minus 5.8%. That's its steepest decline on record.
Got it. So what kept the eurozone up was places like Germany and just other places which were much less affected. Okay. All right. That makes sense.
Now, if we go to Asia, we got some numbers out of China. The Sichuan manufacturing PMI came out for April, and that was at 49.4. Now, I don't know if you want to talk about this, Neil, but we've been saying it's interesting that these China numbers really haven't rebounded as much as some might expect.
Well, they haven't rebounded at all. I mean, in the sense that you had that incredible, you know, drop in February, and ever since the Caixin and I think also the services have been just around 50 or a little bit under 50, which means that this is an economy that's now chugging along on three cylinders. And then it's fascinating, given the new outbreaks breaking out. We've talked about Harbin, you know, in Manchuria, and then there's some new outbreaks that recently have been reported. You know, China is trying to carry out a policy that's something between mitigation, which just means kind of keeping everyone in place, and containment, which successfully would mean, you know, identifying everyone as sick and allowing everyone else to go back to work. But they can't really get to containment. I mean, it's a huge country, and they don't have all the provincial governors and expertise in place to run a successful containment policy. Right. So they remain shut down. And the other point I think China really makes very clear is that it doesn't matter what government does. People are scared to go shopping, and a lot of them are scared to go to work. And a lot of businesses can't maintain the kinds of supply chain interactions that they have in the past, right? And needless to say, also, there's no demand for their exports. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons why this economy isn't functioning as well. So, and then what else have you got?
We got some numbers out of South Korea. We got their market manufacturing PMIs for April, which was 41.6. So it's still quite low there, even though they've had more success fighting the virus. Then in Japan, we got retail sales month over month for March, and that was down 4.5%. And that was actually more than expected. But, you know, this will probably keep going down as Japan is getting worse and worse. Because if you remember, in March, they were still kind of doing okay. And then by the end of it, cases were rising.
Yeah, well, Japan is one of those countries that was actually halfway into recession before the pandemic even hit.
Yes.
So, as Japan often does, it's going to go through this with a very unique trajectory. Already going down before the pandemic hit, initially not being affected as much, but obviously they will be going down as well.
Well, Neil, do you want to take us through why is the market still going up? We've been waiting.
Yeah. Why is the market going up? So this is promising to be one of the briefest bear markets in history, peak to trough. It really kind of depending on how you want to define a bear market and when you're going to end it. I think it would be ended if we ever got back up to our previous high. It went from peak to low in how many weeks? I think that was what about 4 weeks, 3.5 weeks,
yeah,
something like that.
February 19th to March 23rd.
It's also one of the shallowest of any bear market that has been associated with a recession, despite the fact that this recession is projected to be the worst we've experienced since the Great Depression, and in terms of, you know, expected unemployment rise, GDP decline, and so forth. Just for perspective, 2000 and 2002, that was a bear market peak to trough associated with a recession that went on for 30 months and went down 49% in the S&P 500. 2007 to 2009 was a bear market that lasted 17 months, and the S&P 500 went down 56%. This one, you know, obviously lower, faster, kind of halfway rebounded. So what's going on? And I just want to go over and you know, you can evaluate yourself which explanation you think. Obviously, one that comes up time and again is that the market thinks that this recession is its ultimate real effect is overestimated. This is the V-shaped recovery. This is the natural disaster narrative that this is, you know, once the virus goes away, which ought to be quickly, we'll all get back to work and we'll all go back to where we were. And this is just going to be a very unpleasant memory. I often have hypothesized looking at how extremely dire economic projections, ones that look, you know, all out of precedent with the past, perversely actually seem to encourage the markets. It almost validates the market's perception that this is so extraordinary, it couldn't possibly mean anything. Right? So, I mean, so many people are out of work. We've never seen anything like this. That it actually doesn't, it couldn't be an actual recession. It has to be something completely bizarre and strange. Well, needless to say, I don't believe this narrative. And if this is the case, I think certainly the market is going to be corrected in that belief. The virus isn't going anywhere. And even without new waves of the virus, the what the economist calls the 90% economy, they had a great cover story this week, the 90% economy, really referring to China and the fact that, you know, these economies, even well after they contain it, you know, more or less contain the virus, are just simply not functioning at all how they used to. That's going to be with us. And in addition, this this recession is global. I mean, it's hitting everybody. So no one is being spared, no major country, no major area of the world. Here is, I think, another common explanation for why markets are more optimistic than you might think, and that is that governments and central banks, with their massive combined stimulus, they're holding everyone harmless. With huge liquidity and huge amount of lending, they're holding off bankruptcies and defaults, and thereby reducing uncertainty. And I actually think there is something to this explanation. One thing that fascinates me is that if you look at, you know, from an economist's perspective at why stock markets, you know, stock prices decline, they will say that the biggest reason for market valuations is the discount rate. When you suddenly, you know, increasing risk premium causes the equity premium itself to soar, that is to say, when credit spreads hugely increase, all future returns, you know, shrink. They're discounted by a much higher rate. And that overwhelms almost anything else. It certainly overwhelms, you know, how earnings are going to do next quarter, the quarter after that. And it's interesting to me that if you look at the pattern from February 19th, when the credit spreads were at their near their low, to March 23rd, when they peaked, and I think they went up from about, you know, credit spreads between junk bonds and treasuries went up from about 3%, 3 or 4% to about 10 and 11%, and today we're about halfway back, right? So the movement in credit spreads almost exactly mirrors, both in timing and in magnitude, what we've seen in the equity markets. But in my opinion, this is a short-term palliative. What Congress and the Fed is doing is putting the economy into sort of a medically induced coma. It does not solve any of the problems, and many of these companies are not going to survive long-term in any case, at least not in their current form. So this can't keep going on forever, and I think in the future, by the way, more of this assistance is going to be going to workers and states rather than businesses, I think partly because of popular demand. Another lesson that keeps coming up that I hear is that markets have learned the lesson that the U.S. stock market, particularly the S&P, always rebounds higher than it falls. So you're just a chump if you sell. You know what I mean? I mean, You must have felt terrible. I mean, if you had sold in, you know, March of 2009, right? You should have just held, right? You should have been buying stocks. I mean, you would have done really great. I think I hear that particularly from a lot of Gen Xers, you know, naturally kind of a risk-prone generation. They always like to learn from pragmatic experience and just discount all this whining. Just buy when it's cheap and you'll be better off. I think Americans have, in some sense, been spoiled because, unlike many other economies around the world, including Japan and I'd say most of the stock markets in Europe, we've never experienced the stock market going down and then just staying down, never coming back. We haven't experienced that since the 1930s, right? And that, I think, is a question. We would have to repeat a 1930s experience to prove the market wrong on this one. And the question is, will that happen? The U.S. is privileged by the U.S. dollar being the world's reserve currency. That's raised repeatedly. That was certainly raised back in 2008, 2009. We can always print more of it. The world will always come here as a safe haven. The worse things are around the world, you know, the more people invest in the United States. That's another lesson from 2009. And ultimately, of course, this is a privilege that will only come to a definitive end with devaluation of the U.S. dollar or with U.S. inflation, or probably both. And that remains another interesting longer-term possibility we've discussed. No one's looking at, certainly no one's looking at inflation over the next few months, and probably not much devaluation of the dollar. But will that be a longer-term consequence of this extraordinary largesse of the Fed and Congress? Another interesting kind of dovetailing with this is an op-ed by Paul Krugman. They came out in the New York Times, I think, last week. It's kind of an interesting thought. He said that the reason why the stock market's up is that there's nowhere else to put your money. You know, nothing looks good now. And I would say, I think, you know, literally, he's wrong. I mean, obviously, people can always park their money in cash or near cash or gold. But in one sense, I think he pointed to something interesting, and that is, unlike 2008, 2009, there are no areas of the world where that remain healthy. Back then, you know, China was still great. You know, Australia never had a recession. There were other areas of the world. Now there are no other areas of the world. So if you want to be in equities at all, that's the question. Where else do you invest? And I think finally, and something that points a little bit more toward my own analysis of what's going on, is the fact that in this crash we're seeing and this coming recession, the biggest firms are hugely advantaged over small firms. And this helps the S&P 500 over larger indexes that include smaller companies, and certainly over all non-public businesses, you know, all the LLC pass-throughs and proprietorships and all that. I would say this, Christian, in no economic crisis in history have you seen small businesses and contractors punished so much more relative to big businesses. I mean, you know, we're all now buying from Amazon and
right.
You know, or whatever. I mean, it's large businesses. They have the cash to stay in business. They require the least human contact, and they have been the first helped by Congress and Fed policy. And this actually is going to accentuate a trend I've already presented so many times, for Hedgeye and subscribers. A piece I did last year called Declining Business Dynamism in the U.S. More concentration, more incumbency of small numbers of large firms, and a growing gap between the rate of return on the capital invested in established winners versus the marginal rate of return on new investment. By new startups, which is one of the reasons why new startups are so down, which is around near zero today. So we built up these, you know, moats that Warren Buffett likes to talk about, you know, around the winners. They have these spectacular rates of return, and now these winners are being ever more favored. Everything else looks like, you know, everyone else is dead. all the smaller players, all the potential competitors are kind of, you know, just lying there on the battlefield, and these big winners are bigger than ever. And I think a lot of industries, you'll see the winners even doing better than before, because this recession may take out some of their less viable competitors. So this points finally, and let me just kind of summarize my point here to say that it points that to the fact that we're going to have huge problems if this persists, right? We're going to have huge problems in sustaining productivity growth into the future with a small number of incumbents that really don't have to compete, and a huge problem with growing inequality. There's been a number of big essays written recently in the media. You've seen it. We've commented on it a little bit in Newsweek about, you know, the losers really got hit in this recession. Those who are younger, those who are low income, and you see that too in the business world, right? The smaller companies really got hit. But I think it also poses enormous threats. And in that case, we'll simply have much greater inequality, much lower productivity growth and living standards. But in that case, kind of that weird kind of dystopian scenario, we could actually have a high S&P. That's you know, those would be the winners that continue to generate money, but no one else can, right? But I think it also might pose enormous threats to the S&P and equity values if that status quo was challenged. And what we see in these eras, and I've talked about it many times, higher taxes, new welfare programs, massive government spending on infrastructure, and antitrust policy. I mean, everyone's saying that we're in a war on the coronavirus. Well, what happens in war? Taxes go up. I mean, look at World War I, World War II. I mean, you're just looking around. So here you have the parallels a little bit to the 1930s. And I do think, by the way, as long as we're speaking of growing populism, we all know how the 2009 bailouts to the banks and insurance companies were hated by a lot of Americans, both on the left and the right. It gave birth to the 1% movement and all that. But in my opinion, many of the aspects of the CARES Act, and particularly the Payroll Protection Program, the PPP, will be remembered as, for this crisis, as another of the great giveaways to large firms over small. I think I went over this in a call with JT about, you know, how the CARES Act, in fact, has actually worked. But all of the bigger companies, many of them publicly traded, have moved to the front of the line for banks. And a lot of these companies had a lot more than 500 employees. I mean, these were big, thriving, successful companies. And the guy in the corner of the hardware store in the laundromat was shoved to the end of the line. And most of these people have not received a penny yet. And some banks have just tarnished their reputation. I think J.P. Morgan Chase was the most flagrant in favoring large companies, according to new data released by the Small Business Administration. I know the National Federation for Independent Businesses is screaming murder on this. But I think we have the makings here of another seed of a real popular protest to what's gone on. And I'm not talking here about, you know, workers versus business capital. I'm talking about capital versus capital, right? About winners and losers in the business world. And that story hasn't been pretty.
That is a grim outlook you've given us, Neil.
Well, it's not a grim outlook. I mean, it's just, you know, I just tell it like it is. And if, you know, yeah, some people, they get sell. So, but I think that's where we are. Yeah, I guess now they think of it, it is kind of grim, isn't it? All right. Well, let's move on to something. Let's move on to something else. Let's. What's next on our agenda? I think we want to talk about politics, don't we?
Yeah. So do some politics around the world.
Yeah. Why don't we start? What's why don't you go first, and I'll chime in here.
I'll start with some news that's been coming out of Brazil that their president, Bolsonaro, has stepped in some hot water recently. About a week ago, he fired his federal chief of police without explanation. Now, this prompted the Justice Minister, Sergio Moro, to resign from his position and accuse Bolsonaro of trying to replace the police chief with a political ally to control investigations. Now, this minister who stepped down is kind of seen as a moral crusader in Brazil. He was a judge that put away a lot of corrupt politicians. And since this allegation, the Brazilian Supreme Court has started an investigation against Bolsonaro. There is now a movement for impeachment. And recent polls are showing that around half of Brazilians agree that they think he should be kicked out of office.
And yeah, this justice minister was the guy who ran Operation Lava Jato. That's called yes. Operation Car Wash in Brazil, right? And he was the one who put, you know, Dilma Rousseff, impeached her, and it's the one who got out Lula, you know, before her. I mean, corruption in office is it seems to be a systemic problem in Brazil. And yes. I believe this was all done by Jair in favor of one or both of his sons. Is that correct?
Right. One of his sons is a senator who was on some money laundering charges and some tax evasion.
And I would just add to that, one additional problem is his other minister, which is the one actually great thing that Bolsonaro did, was to reform the pension system. I mean, I've talked about that a lot. I mean, you know, we talk about demography on this show, and, you know, nothing, I'm focused on nothing so much as, you know, pension issues. And Brazil had one of the most absolutely horrendously out of kilter pension system in the world. The most generous benefits, completely unfunded, absolutely unsustainable. And he actually did succeed through this finance minister. I can't remember what his name was. It was their minister of finance. But he is now threatening himself to resign. So here's a, you know, Bolsonaro might soon just be all alone up there.
Yeah, and he's already getting a lot of criticism of how he's been dealing with COVID. With Brazil has had one of the worst outbreaks in South America.
Yeah, well, we've certainly talked about that. Yeah. So what else is going on?
We also have a kind of unfolding situation here in Venezuela, where Maduro has claimed on Sunday that he stopped a coup in an attempted assassination against his life. They have arrested 8 to 6 people that they caught on a boat trying to get into the country. And 2 of them have been identified as Americans who are part of this Florida private security company. And Maduro has gone to the press saying that America has tried to make an assassination attempt on his life. We don't know much about this company or these Americans who are over there, but that's just something that's unfolding as we speak.
Well, it's, even if it didn't happen, he would love for it to happen because it bolsters his authority. So,
right, it's a great story.
all right.
If we go down to New Zealand, where, you know, we've been talking about how well New Zealand and Australia have dealt with the coronavirus, that the two countries are actually in talks right now to start in the future opening up regional air traffic and travel between them. And, you know, this has always been a question, as a lot of countries have shut down their borders, how will travel around the world resume? And they're looking like they're going to start a model if it's just going to be regional. They know that both countries are pretty good at bringing down the virus. But the question is going to be, when this starts, are you going to see a spike in cases again?
Well, one interesting feature of containment as a policy for the pandemic is that you can get, if you start isolating, you know, do all the tracing and testing, you isolate, you bring the infection way down. The few infections there are, you know where they are. There's one big weakness, and that is people coming in from the outside, right? And not being able to track them. So one aspect of containment as a policy is, the better and better you are at it relative to everyone else in the world, the more and more you have to just intensely check everyone coming across your border. It's actually one of the problems in the United States with the federal system. How do you do that with 50 governors, right? Even the states are beginning to form coalitions, right? So California, Oregon, and Washington are part of a coalition. You have the Northwestern states, you know, we're sort of breaking up. America's breaking up into pieces on this. But I think you can easily see how two countries that have are pursuing very successfully containment want to make a special bilateral relationship. I know there are a couple of two stories. We're running out of time, but I wanted to get to them quickly. In Germany, the Constitutional Court, Germany's Constitutional Court in Karlsruhe, ruled against the European Central Bank's expansive new quantitative easing and fiscal stimulus programs. And you remember that originally back after the GFC, when the ECB did a lot of quantitative easing, it had all these rules on buying up sovereign debt of various countries. It could only do so in proportion to each country's size, as measured by its contribution to the European Central Bank's capital. And it could not buy more than one-third of any individual country's total eligible public debt. Well, apparently these new programs in place, particularly this new pandemic emergency purchase program, the PEPP, is ignoring all these rules. And apparently the German court said this violates the European Union's fundamental constitution that said it would never do this. And one former head of the ECB, Vitor Constantio, said the German court was trying to make, and it's very interesting, he said, a ridiculous distinction between monetary and economic policy, right? Meaning that in this new world, I've said this, I don't know how often I've said this on the show, Christian, is that in this new world, there is no distinction between monetary and economic policy. You know, it's like we're all going to be like China. You know, fiscal policy, monetary policy, what difference does it make? You know, you just create liquidity everywhere. You just give people income. So in a way, it's like Germany is trying to, you know, hearken back to the what now seems like this medieval idea, you know, that there actually is a monetary policy and there's a fiscal policy. They should remain distinct. And I think it's a sign of how things are changing today that people say, no, I don't know. What's different about it? We're all modern monetary theorists now, which means that there is no such distinction. So we'll see where that turns out. And one last item, I know you flagged this to me. It's absolutely fascinating. This Luca Zaia, governor of Veneto. This is the Italian state that province that includes Venice. He was the first to devise a widespread drive-through testing program. He's been very successful at dealing with the coronavirus. There have been only 1,500 deaths in Veneto relative to 14,000 in Lombardy. And he's been keeping people out of the hospital. It turns out that in Italy, hospitals have turned out to be one of the main sources of transmission. You know, people just being herded into hospitals. I've never told you this, Christian, but I was actually one summer in an Italian hospital, and I can just tell you that's just not a place you want to be if you're trying not to get a disease. I'll tell you that right now. So what's happening is Luca Zaia is a member of the Lega Nord, and he is now beginning to eclipse Matteo Salvini as a popular leader for the Lega Nord, for the right wing. Coalition. So there you have Matteo Salvini, the Il Capitano, you know, the guy who's ahead of the right wing. He's beginning to get eclipsed. And I know this Luca Zaia, who many people are calling, Signor, you know, Mr. 80% or Il Doge, you know, that's the name of the leader of Venice, the Doge, you know. So Salvini's popularity has fallen from the mid-30s to the mid-20s. He's still pretty popular, but he's no longer the same contender he used to be. And a new poll on how leaders have handled the crisis. Zaia was on top, I think, at 46%. Conte and Sergio Mattarella, who's the president, are in the mid-30s, and Salvini is down at around 20%. So I think one thing you see in Italy, and it's very interesting, it's not unlike what we've seen in a lot of other countries of the world, are those who actually can successfully execute and administer a forceful agenda, that kind of rallies the country successfully, are soaring in popularity ratings. So what you see for these governors in Italy is not completely unlike what you've seen in governors in the United States.
Right. We've often talked about how people like Cuomo are in the U.S. have their popularity soaring.
Right. Right. So, well, we have politics. We're running out of time. There's a lot I really wish I could have said. I think maybe we'll talk about this next time. I did want to talk a little bit about what's happening to conservatives. You've got Justin Amash, who's, you know, beginning to apparently running as a libertarian with very interesting possible effects on the election in 2020. You have the libertarian of the wing, and then you have kind of the big government conservatism wing making bigger news. People like, you know, Mitt Romney and Marco Rubio, and even pretty, you know, hardliners like Tom Cotton, more hawkish than Trump on defense, but much more open than Trump on the role of government to protect the war and to prepare America in terms of industrial policy to be independent in this new post-globalist world. In other words, these are kind of, yeah, Tory conservatives, big government conservatives, you might call them. I'm not sure what you'd call Trump. He's sort of a mixture of a lot of things, right? He's right. Kind of, well, he's a little bit of libertarian, but he's a little bit of populist, but he's a little bit of pro, you know, he's kind of hard. But anyway, you see a little bit of the splitting up. And I think this is a sign that people are beginning to prepare for the possibility, at least, of a post-Trump grand old party, a post-Trump Republican Party. And the last thing I'd like to point out is this piece by David Axelrod and David Plouffe, both Obama campaign managers in 2008, just basically telling Joe Biden, get out of the basement, right? Polls still show Biden ahead of Trump. The futures markets generally favor Biden, not by a large margin. One interesting new set of polls, this was released by The Economist, shows that Biden, one thing is going to his favor, that relative to Hillary Clinton, Biden does relatively better among non-college whites, and that actually augurs very well for how he's going to do in the swing states, right? The ones he has to get. So obviously, if these states are hard hit economically and Biden does relatively better in reaching out to them, he may do better in the Electoral College, even with the same, you know, popular vote performance as Hillary got.
Right.
So that's another interesting thing to keep track of. But I will agree that, I mean, you asked the question about this whole, you know, Me Too scandal surrounding Biden.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know what to think of that, except that, let's face it, this is why no one was terribly enthusiastic about Sleepy Joe. Isn't that what the president calls him? Sleepy Joe.
Yeah, he calls him Sleepy Joe.
And he really represents a desire to sort of go back to what America was before Trump. I mean, that's kind of those Democrats who think we should just go back to where we were before Trump and somehow just forget it ever happened. I think when I look at younger voters today, they don't want to go back before Trump. They want to go beyond Trump. You know what I mean?
It's like right.
The world moves forward. It doesn't move back. And I don't know your thoughts on this, Christian.
Well, it's the popularity with millennials for someone like Bernie Sanders. He's offering something different that hasn't been done before. And I think for a lot of people, Biden, you know, he is going backwards, and that's why he's not exciting. And that's why a lot of people aren't all thrilled that he's the nominee.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, the problem, though, with Bernie Sanders and with Elizabeth Warren, and I've said this in many contexts, is that their left agenda in the culture makes them just unpalatable, not even for most Americans, but even for most Democrats. And I think that's what sunk both of them. I think particularly that was true with Elizabeth Warren. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going into an era now where, you know, people are moving, you know, left on how economic institutions work, but actually in a somewhat conservative direction on the culture, much as we did, by the way, back in the 1930s and 40s. And this is a turnings movement. This is a shift generated by generational aging and generational change. And back in the 1980s and 1990s, almost everyone, both Republicans and Democrats, were trying to move to be more progressive in the culture and more conservative or free market oriented in the economy, right? I mean, that was the new Democrats with Clinton and Tony Blair. And, you know, the Republicans were trying to get all kind of hip, you know, in the culture, kind of culturally libertarian. I think today, actually, we're moving in somewhat the opposite direction in terms of electability. And I think the problem is that, you know, our political class hasn't yet caught up with that shift yet. So there we are. We certainly are out of time, Christian. I want to thank everyone for being with us for another Demography Unplugged broadcast. Again, just a plug to subscribe. Just, you know, Google Demography Unplugged if you're interested. Please come on Thursday at 12:30. This will be our last public COVID-19 update call. Looking forward to talking with a lot of you then. So until next week, this is Demography Unplugged. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Demography Unplugged. Tune in next time. If you have any questions about this broadcast or have suggestions for future topics, please contact qademography@hedgeye.com. Also, if you'd like to see more of what I have to offer, visit us online at hedgeye.com, and also make sure to follow me on Twitter at HowGeneration. That's H-O-W-E, Generation.
Hedgeye Risk Management is a registered investment advisor registered with the state of Connecticut. Hedgeye Risk Management is not a broker-dealer and does not provide investment advice for individuals. This research does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security. This research is presented without regard to individual investment preferences or risk parameters. It is general information and does not constitute specific investment advice. Nothing presented herein should be construed as legal or tax advice. This presentation is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye Risk Management is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual speaking and not necessarily those of Hedgeye, and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye Risk Management's clients and subscribers. In reaching these opinions and conclusions, the individuals expressing those opinions and conclusions and their employees have relied upon research which is based upon sources considered credible and reliable within the industry. Neither Hedgeye Risk Management nor any individual expressing those opinions and conclusions are responsible for the validity or authenticity of the information upon which it has relied.